Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And if you've listened for a while, you'll probably realize I'm not huge on tell me your business's origin story type episodes. I tend to like to get into the nitty-gritty of what guests or what founders are doing now that can be helpful to you who's listening. But I have to make an exception for the owners of SPE Motorsports, Amy and Dan Snyder. They've got a business that sells performance custom automotive products, especially for Ford vehicles. And their story is just phenomenal. And it's allowed them to build what I think is almost like just the perfect example of the type of business in e-com that is going to thrive going forward. And so we get into their story. And also, just as impressively, or even more so, is we talk about how they've been able to build up an in-house manufacturing capability that allows them to design, prototype, and fabricate products all in-house. It's pretty cool what they're able to do. Anyway, a lot of fun stuff. I enjoyed their story. They're two fantastic people. And I think there's some lessons for how you think about building a real viable, durable, long-lasting business in what they have to share. So hope you enjoy it. And we're going to get right into it. Amy, Dan, great to have you on the podcast. And we're going to dive into the whole story of how the business came about, how you're doing a lot of really interesting in-house manufacturing, how you built the brand. But I want to start by talking about your car collection. You've got, I won't go into all of it, but you've got a very cool collection of cars. Reminded me of surprised you haven't. It would not surprise me if you've, haven't synced up with Jay Leno at some point to talk about stuff. Perhaps you could each give me one or two of your favorites in that collection, because it's a super cool collection.
All right.
You can start.
All right, I'll start. Okay. So I think my favorite is we have a Superformance GT40. Well, I'll let you explain the GT40 thing that we've got going on.
Well, for non-car people, if you've seen the movie Ford versus Ferrari.
Yes.
The GT40 is basically the hero of that movie. That car was pretty much from 1964 to 1970. Basically, they just shut the whole manufacturing of that car down. Whenever they got rid of that, they had basically sold it off to another company. So they sold off the tooling, the dies, the licensing, everything for that car. And then it sat on the back burner, and then they started just producing them again in the early 90s. So they took this car that ended production in the 70s. It was a street legal car that Ford was racing, and then brought it back in the early 90s, but they were continuation cars. And the VIN number actually picked up from where they left off in the 70s, and Ford recognized that because they owned the licensing and all the other stuff required to do it. It just makes it really cool because you can really buy a 1970 car brand new today that, the VIN number picked up from 1970. So it's just a
very
continuation.
Authentic 1970.
And it's made on all the original tooling.
And so this car is, it's pretty much exact. You can buy, it's made new in 2025, but it's effectively exactly the same model that rolled off the lines in the 70s.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's incredible. I've got an old 1990, very different. You guys are in super performance, Ford automobiles. This is the exact opposite end of the spectrum, the slowest vehicle you could get. It's that 1990 VW Synchro Vanagon. And I love this thing so much because it's a great camping and adventure vehicle. We've had tons of adventures with our family in it, but it's starting to show its age at 30, 35 years old. But the beauty of it, you can't make them anymore today because of safety standards and things like that, which maybe I shouldn't be driving my family around. I've thought about this thing. But, you go to Europe and there's a lot of amazing camper van vehicles over there, but you can't bring them to the US. So if I was going to pull you could potentially get around it. You can either wait 25 or 30 years and import it, or you can just pull the engine of the tranny and ship it over, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
I think it's becoming, I feel like, more of a trend as time goes on because you have, for instance, your Volkswagen, then you have people who are just diehard Porsche guys, but they want the old Porsches. You know what I mean? They don't want the newer stuff. And So there's already companies starting to do that where they're basically making old Porsches and all kinds of crazy stuff. So
yeah,
there's such a beauty and a romance and oftentimes a functionality to some of the older vehicles. But the problem is, as they age, if you start fixing stuff piecemeal here and there, it gets horrifically expensive. At some point, you either have to decide, okay, we're either going to scrap it or we're going to just rebuild the whole thing from the ground up.
Right. Well, and then the hard part is sometimes finding the parts. You know, that mm-hmm. stuff's not made anymore. Mm-hmm. Or you're paying out of pocket to have something done custom that's just even more insanely expensive. Been there. And now.
Yeah. And trying to find people to work on it. I mean, I've called people up to try to, because my rig has got it's a VW, but it's got a Subaru engine in it to try to, you know, take it from 0 to 60, from, you know, maybe 15 seconds down to maybe 12, just a little bit more power. Yes. I've had people laugh at me when I tell them, I'm like, hey, here's what I got. Can you work on it? And they just bust up laughing. They're like, yeah, sorry, son. Good luck. Click, you know, dial tone. So how did I'm guessing you're both huge Ford fans and loyalists because that's what you service. Is that the case, or am I reading between the lines too much there?
No, I think that's fair.
No, I always say to people, I'm blue blooded, but I love the automotive industry, as a whole. So, you know, for instance, if you were just to say pick a vehicle that you could do every single thing with, and you know all that, I would definitely lean more towards Ford. Just because we're comfortable with it. We know a lot about it. You know, it's definitely our priority brand, I would say. But we have all kinds of different stuff. So,
yeah. So preference, but you won't. You'll speak to GMC and Chevy drivers.
Yes. Like that serious. Yeah. In fact, we've had them. So yeah. Some of the cool things is just being able to say like, well, yeah, I like Ford because I can appreciate it. And I also have had Chevy and I know the difference, you know, like.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that makes us really well-rounded as car people is we've owned all the things that we'll talk to people about, you know, rather than a lot of the times you'll be in a conversation in a room with somebody and, you know, Chevy this, Chevy that. And it's like, well, have you ever owned a Ford? Well, no. Okay. Well then don't call them crap then. You know,
I would love to start with kind of the early days of the business. And you guys had kind of a by your own admission, I believe, at least reading on a few things, kind of a rough 8 years in the service industry getting through that. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because that seemed like it was maybe a hard time, but pretty instrumental into the genesis story of the business.
Yeah, sure. I'll let Dan speak on that because he was the forefront of all of the initial starting of the business.
How far back you want me to go?
All right. Go from high school beyond and don't make it too long.
Yeah. So, I mean, just a quick background on kind of where my mindset came from. Grew up racing, whether it was drag racing or dirt bikes or whatever, part of my family. After I graduated, I ended up at a Ford dealership just to get my feet wet. And within the first 2 years, I became a master certified Ford technician, which was a really accelerated rate. But being that I had been wrenching since I was 10 years old, you know, it wasn't hard for me to push on, really accelerate that. After that, I was working on the side at home, you know, doing custom stuff for people, whether it was a drag race car, whether it was performance modifications, custom fabrication stuff, things of that nature. I'd be doing at home in the evenings. And it got to the point where, you know, Amy decided, hey, we want to get married. We want to, you know, start a life, and you're burning the candle at both ends. You know, we want to start getting more serious. And she goes, well, you need to decide what you want to do. So I decided, let's do it. Let's start our own business. But at the time, you know, I'm still pretty young. I had no idea about anything business oriented. You know, it was just, I knew what I was good at, but didn't know how to operate a business. So started the business up. Luckily, my father was at the time building a building on his property, and I ended up kind of going in with him on it. And I was like, all right, I'm going to throw in some time, some money, help you build this, and I need a bay. So he gave me basically like one garage bay. And I'm like, I'll just work out of this and just, you know, keep doing what I've been doing. Did that, and it exploded, and we were super busy. Not super profitable, but super busy.
And at this time, are you doing So are you doing modification work? So you're doing the same stuff you're doing on the side, either customizing or performance enhancements, things like that?
So we were doing that, but I also intermixed
like service,
the service stuff, because it was a good filler. A lot of the modification-based things and performance-based stuff is very time-consuming. So you may have one vehicle for months, you know, just depending on what you're doing. So it was nice to have the service because it was a good filler. You know, somebody stopped and they're like, hey, my car, whatever it may be, has this problem. Can you fix it? So we did that a lot too. But then it pretty much transitioned, I would say, within the first 3 or 4 years, more into the performance-oriented work and the custom stuff. And I would say that was within the first 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
It kind of transitioned into that. And then we were about, I'd say, 6 years in, 7 years in, and we started getting to the point where it was just, all right, we're not making money. We need to figure out.
We had kids at this point too. So right. I was, during this process, when we started the business, I'm an RN. So I'm working 3/12s, night shift, coming home. And now I'm working the business, trying to take phone calls, be the secretary, you know, handle all of the things.
And of course, we're trying to put all the money back in.
Correct.
So we weren't taking really anything.
Yeah.
From
so we were living off of my paycheck, and then we get pregnant back to back. So our babies are 10 and a half months apart, and we're like, crap, now I have to stop working because we're raising babies. So now babies are coming to the shop every day, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to take, like, you know, 10 bucks an hour just to offset something so that we're getting some sort of paycheck. But yeah, so at that point, it was the end of 18, and we're pretty much like, okay, this sucks. We hate this. We had like a serious conversation. Are we continuing on or what are we doing?
But preluding to that, we had a lot of work that we were doing where, and this was where I was wrong on my end. We had a lot of work that we were doing where we should have been manufacturing the parts and the components that we were making, but instead I was doing more one-off custom stuff every time something came in. So, you know, as an example, you know, a customer brings us a vehicle. We do this crazy build on it. We do all kinds of stuff to it, all kinds of modifications. They ship it across the country to us, and then we ship it back. And they really like it. Then all of a sudden, his buddy calls and says, like, hey, I want the same thing. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you know, me not thinking and having my normal mindset of just, let's just make it as we go, I wasn't smart enough to actually do it from an aspect of manufacturing. I was doing it from a custom aspect. So now I'd have this other vehicle come. We'd have to do everything all over again from scratch. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have the same outcome, but it was all done the hard way, let's call it, you know? So at that point, we had all these customers that were coming to us who were like, oh man, I really want this. Basically, they're looking at it like a product, but we weren't manufacturing it like a product. You know, we were just doing this custom stuff every time.
So you're talking about, when you're talking about custom stuff, metalwork, fabrication. So you were fabricating custom mounts or pieces or mufflers or whatever it is, or intakes, right, or
turbo systems, turbo systems, piping stuff,
yeah.
Custom building parts for engines.
And we had no processes in place. So we were just like,
I mean, we had a lot of the,
okay, next one.
Right. We had a lot of the talent and the know-how to do it, but we didn't have any structure to go from because nobody that was working within the company had any kind of manufacturing background. So that kind of got to the point where it was like, oh man, we're overwhelmed. We have all this going on, you know, in our regular life. And then also, you know, people wanting this stuff. And at that point we had started trying to produce some products, but we were still doing service.
So 2018 rolls around and we're, you know, doing this. We're living in a 700 square foot house. Dan, 2 kids. We're way out of space at home. The shop is just like, we're hating life. So I'm like, all right, let's start looking for houses. We got to find something. Somebody's got to have something with a big garage on it. Like, we're just going to find a house and then we'll figure it out from there. So we are looking and
we didn't have a lot of cars then, but we still had
cars. We had a couple cars. So we just wanted a garage to be able to work out of. We're like, if we can get a garage to work out of, like, we'll just figure it out. We're either going to downsize significantly and we're just going to do strictly repair.
But at that point, we had the discussion of you came to me once again. I always say Amy's like my balance. She comes to me and gives me, you know, options and says pick, and then that's what we're doing. So she says to me, she's like, all right, you're burning the candle again at both ends. We either need to do products or we need to do service.
Yeah. So it's the end of 2018. We find a house, and at the same time, we're like, look, we find this place in an industrial park that we're going to rent. And so, but we had, our product line was like three products. We had like nothing. We had no idea how we were going to make this work. So we, but the day we bought our house, we signed with this industrial park, and part of our lease agreement was we're not allowed to do any service. So we're like, well, sink or swim, I guess. We're either going to make this happen or we're just going to default on this lease and we're going to go back to 9 to 5s. And so that's the end of 18. I think in beginning of 2019, we're just finally starting to like figure out how to produce products. But in the meantime, we're also fixing problems because we were, you know, we had all these customers that we were doing like transmission stuff for, engine build, stuff like that. And we had a tech that was just like in the back burner stealing from us also. So he was building things and saying they were ours. So now we're like trying to save our name. So we're also fixing things that we never did. So we had a rough start, and then COVID.
Well, and then prior to this, we knew it was coming. And I knew I needed to learn more about the manufacturing process. So obviously I had to learn CAD, and drawing two dimensionally on paper, I was fine, but obviously modeling, parametric modeling is a whole nother, mm-hmm. another deal. So at that point, you know, in 2016, I had started learning that just because I knew at some point I was going to need it. So luckily I had started taking some online stuff and mastering that. Mm-hmm. And I had a little bit of a head start before we made the full transition. But yeah, at the time I was doing, you know, anything that we'd done machining wise in-house was all done manually on manual machines that we had. So we hadn't done any CNC up to that point.
So I mean, a little bit, maybe not how you'd planned it or sketched it out, but I mean, from this side of the table, doesn't seem like there's any way that was without having been in the trenches, without having built so many of those things, without having understood the vehicles for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, you wouldn't have had the foundation to be able to build all the cool parts you do, which is
absolutely not.
No, definitely not necessary.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, yeah, I guess what's the saying? You got to take the good with the bad and the bad with the good.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing.
Yeah. So it's definitely been an interesting transition. You know, neither of us had any sort of background in any of this. So it was definitely, what is the term, like learning by fire?
<You know? laughs> Baptism by fire. Yeah.
Baptism by fire. That's it. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely been an interesting, you know, struggle, I should say.
What was the turning point? I know you had a moment where, you know, you went from doing kind of low tens of thousands per month to doing, you know, in the six figures, meaningful six figures every month in about 2021. What was it that really accelerated that growth for you? Was it just kind of natural? You got your processes figured out and word of mouth spread? Did you, you know, start putting, you know, paid advertisement? What was it that really catalyzed the growth of the business?
We didn't start doing paid advertising until like right before Black Friday last year. I think a lot of it was just like, we kind of would play a game of like, write things on the board and figure, like, try to hit these goals. Well, and so we worked really hard.
I think a lot of it, though, I think what he's asking,
yeah,
at least from my perspective, is I think the turning point was when we moved and we knew we couldn't do service. So we had to take that time that we were allotting to say managing a shop, managing employees. We took that time that we were allotting to that was really soaking up our days.
Yeah.
And then I was able to actually focus on just one thing, which was make products, learn how to do it, learn manufacturing techniques. You know, like, I think it was more of a, I think it was more of like time, you know, like being able to devote it where we needed to.
I think so too. And some of that I'll say too is just realizing that you can work really hard, but it doesn't mean you're working really smart. And that was something we had to figure out is like working.
I was done with that.
Right. Working smart is not necessarily easy. It's easy to work hard. You just, you know, but sometimes it's, you're not checking anything off the list. So I think that was something we had to figure out. And again, you know, we did a lot of, we're very competitive. So we would put goals on the board and we would be like, all right, I want to do this. And then we'd like never put hard enough goals. I feel like though either. Cause we would always blow them out of the water.
There was one year where I was trying to do a minimum of like 2 to 3 products a week, like from idea to design, to prototype, to testing, to
release.
Like I was just trying. You know, we just really hunkered down. But then, you know, we never, at least I feel we didn't, we never put anything out subpar. I mean, we're always very passionate about, you know, what we're putting out.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to David, who's the owner of dropguys.com, where they make super heavy duty phone cases. He's a newer member to e-commerce fuel. And here's what he had to say about his experience with our vetted private community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
My favorite aspect of e-commerce fuel is the community. The reason being is because having gone through the membership application process, I know that everyone is verified, everyone is legit, and everyone's very transparent. Whereas on other communities, such as Reddit, Twitter, you don't really know how much authority they have, how much success they have had, and whether how much weight to give to their opinions. Whereas on e-commerce fuel, you know they're tried and tested, and you can act on their advice with confidence.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Well, I think most people listening think 2 to 3 products per week, and that just seems insane. I mean, there's people, myself included at times, that it's taken 6 months to release a single product, if not longer, right? Like some people work on a product for years, like a year plus. You have this amazing capability and very well earned given the sweat equity and the decade plus you put into it, and also the manufacturing capacity and skills you've built up in-house to be able to think through, prototype it with your CAD, be able to make it with your fabrication stuff on site and test it out, which is pretty phenomenal. And I wonder for people thinking about maybe potentially going down this route, in some industries you can do it, some you can't. But what were some of the things that helped you get there? Obviously, there's the time investment, the knowledge investment. But what were some of the mistakes building out those in-house manufacturing capabilities? Some of the lessons you learned there, others might be able to learn from.
One of the biggest things that we do, and I think you know exactly where I'm going with this, because we've seen
stemmed from a mistake.
It did stem from a mistake, but also it's stuff we have seen other people in our industry do that's not correct. But one thing that we do is if we own or if we make a product for a platform, so like say it's a certain year model vehicle, we own it. Like we will not make a product for something that we do not own. And that helps us on the fitment aspect of it, the testing aspect, the R&D, you know, the whole, basically, let's call it the whole encompassing thing of the product, you know, because
when you say own, sorry to interrupt, Dan, but when you say own, you mean you own the vehicle. So like you get a Ford 2024 Raptor, you're making a part for it. You own that Raptor year.
Correct. Correct. So like, for instance, like the Super Duty, they, from 2011 to current, they have the 6.7 engine in them.
The diesel
6.7 power strip, but from 11 to 14 is a variation of it. And then from 15 to 16 is a variation, and then 17, you know, and so on and so forth. And they have those variation changes. We own each variation change because we make products for each different variation. So we don't need five or six trucks.
Or 10.
You know, or 10 or whatever. But we have them because it makes the product better.
Yeah.
Because we are able to keep an eye on the vehicle. We constantly run them. We're able to keep an eye on the product over like long time periods. So if we see something, which I have another story on that, which we can touch on at some point. But if we see an issue with something, we're able to correct it.
And yeah, doing that did stem from a problem because we manufactured something not realizing there was a model change because we had a 11 to 14, we had a 15, but we didn't have a 17 and they made a change in 17. And so we had to borrow a friend's truck to find that out because somebody, we sent something out, a customer had an issue. We had to borrow a friend's truck to see that. And then the very next day we were like buying that truck. Which wasn't new at the time. So now we're trying to scour the internet to find one that like met our needs.
But the messed up part is we actually had one at one point, got rid of it because we're like, oh, we don't need this anymore.
Yeah. And this was during COVID. So, you know, now we also had good luck finding it.
What did you learn on the in-house side in terms of actually setting up the manufacturing process, either from the CAD development to the machines you have, to the quality control, to processes? What was the hardest part of actually building out that in-house capacity of building the actual products?
One of my big things, I think, from an outside perspective, not being the one that's the manufacturing aspect of it, but we hired a consultant to help us try to figure out what to do. And that was the absolute worst money spent. We wasted 6 months of time and payments.
It was like
$40,000 or $50,000 worth of just wasted money. And what we learned was we just need to know how to do it ourselves because at the end of the day, you can always rely on yourself. You can't always rely on somebody else. And so Dan, again, was baptism by fire.
So that at that time, what she's talking about is when we transitioned, where we were using initially job shops locally to us to manufacture our parts. I would do the design work, the testing. But initially, obviously, we didn't have a bunch of CNC machines. So I was outsourcing the CNC work. I would give them all the files dimensioning, you know, tolerances that we needed to hit. And then they would produce the product for us. We'd get it in, check everything, kit it, make sure everything was right. And then, you know, obviously sell the product. When we first got into the CNC aspect of manufacturing, we had no background in it. So, you know, our initial thought was, okay, yeah, I know the CAD side, but I don't know programming. You know, I didn't know, you know, like as far as programming the CNC machines, I had no idea. So at that time, you know, we had got our first machine and then Amy thought, well, maybe we should look into having someone help with us with this, you know, to kind of speed the process up and all that. And it almost seemed, I don't know, it's hard to paint a picture of that dynamic, but
it was the biggest waste of money.
We hired somebody to come in and basically even help us learn, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was just absolutely terrible. You know, it was more like they wanted to come in and tell us who to hire so that they could, you know what I mean, get like help us from that aspect of it rather than teaching us. And it was just a horrible waste of money. But once again, taking the good with the bad and the bad with the good, whatever, however you want to look at it, I learned from that experience and decided, all right, I need to hunker down and actually learn this. So I came in the one weekend completely by myself and I moved within the suite of my software. I went from the manufacturing part of it the design part of it to the programming side of it. Just started plugging away at it and learned tooling, learned programming, learned, you know, how to do it.
And by Sunday, you made a part.
By the end of the weekend, I had made my first part, you know, and didn't have any, you know, knock on wood at the time. I didn't have any major issues with it, but yeah, we just started rolling.
But that helped us in the hiring process too, because then we knew what we needed.
Right. Yeah. I, you know, looking at it and you know, knowing that, okay, we started running our parts in-house at that point. Obviously, it got to the point where, all right, now we have 5-6 machines. So now I need to be working as an engineer in our company, but I can't be out there running the machines, changing parts out, you know, doing all of it. Mm-hmm. And we had a little bit of help, but not enough. So then we knew what we needed at that point.
What's kind of a life cycle for idea to bring something to market? I know that you know, sometimes it sounds like in the past, maybe even today, you'll be able to make a couple parts in a week or launch a couple new products in a week. Others, in reading in your website and some of the other stuff, it seems like sometimes it takes years of development, a year plus of development to get a part out there.
I would say it's going to be based on the complexity of the part. If it's something pretty simple, it's not bad. But if there's a lot of moving components, like let's base it off of price. Yeah. You know, if it's a part that's $1,000+, yeah, it's probably going to be 6 months, you know, or potentially 2 years. Longer. Potentially longer. Because it, you know, for instance, something like say a turbocharger, you know, if we're developing a new turbo and, you know, we put something like that, that's spinning 100,000 RPMs on a car, you can't put something on there that you think is going to work and then sell it to somebody. You know, you have to, you know, there's safety factors with a lot of this stuff.
But if it's like a plug, like a drain plug or something, exactly. That's super easy to just be like, all right, here it is, let's go.
Here's a drain plug. Yeah.
So something that goes back to that. So are you, imagine you're doing that turbo, for example, you got your own vehicle, you're putting that turbo on, you're running it for a bunch of reps, you're stress testing it, you're seeing how it performs.
Correct. Yeah. So we have, you know, obviously we have test equipment here. We have two different dyno cells. So we have a mainline dyno, which is like a hub dyno that bolts. You take the wheels and tires off and physically bolt it to the axles. And then we can do all kinds of different stress testing with it, horsepower runs, but also we can do different load testing. So I can simulate, you know, pulling a grade or, you know, something like that, for instance. And then we have a regular chassis dyno, which you would just back the car on and roll the rollers.
You know, how do you think about from advertising perspective, where do you get most of your customers and traffic? You mentioned you haven't really experimented with paid traffic up until last year. And if I had to guess, it seems like word of mouth is a big deal. I know people in the car space, myself included, will get on and spend hours talking about the nuances of every little facet of the vehicles that they love. And if you build something great, you know, word of mouth spreads there pretty quickly. How are you getting customers? Is it a combination of online, word of mouth, and just kind of general people? Because it sounds like you're doing it, be able to drive up a lot of business without having to spend a lot on advertising.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is people just talk, like word of mouth on Facebook posts and stuff like that. We had a YouTube video go viral in like 2011, maybe 2012, somewhere around there. So that was like when YouTube was easy. So it's still every once in a while will like recirculate and then people see it there. But I think a lot of it has just been word of mouth. We do a small amount of events, but I mean, that's maybe once or twice a year if we even hit any events in a year. We're doing our first trade show this year. We've never done that. Yeah, usually Dan is just trying to like push the boundaries. It's not uncommon for us to buy something new and he's intentionally trying to break it to see like failure points, to see like where it's going to break, what horsepower is it going to break at. And I think some of that has gotten us notoriety because not many people were willing to buy like a $100,000 vehicle and intentionally try to break it. And not just for like views, but actually to make better products. Because a lot of it, you know, people are doing it for views.
Yeah, it's not. We're doing it in an analytical kind of way.
And, yeah.
You know, breaking it down from an engineering aspect and looking at things and comparing things. And
yeah. So we're super niche. So I think that helps as well, just because.
Which I think that kind of helps us as a brand.
Yeah. There's not a lot of competitors, but there's not a lot of vehicles then in that aspect because the pool is so small.
Yeah. I have this concept I've talked about. If people listen to the show for a while, they've probably heard me spitball on is, which is this idea of the small durable brands, like this kind of new, this new ethos of e-commerce brands that are going to be the ones that survive and thrive in the next 10 years and that they're not reliant on advertising. They can use advertising, but they're mostly reliant on a core team that's really passionate about a very interesting, unique product. And they grow more slowly, but they're going to have a lot more durability because it's harder to get in and unseat them. They've got a lot of subject area expertise. They have a lot of word of mouth. They have a brand and a product that people, you know, love. And I feel like you guys have just built just the absolute, you know, case study in this, right? Like it was hard won and hard fought. You had to get the experience the only way you can by just trial and error and making mistakes. But now you've got this totally vertically integrated brand with products and an industry you love, with fans and customers that are coming to you, whether you advertise or not. And maybe you'll never sell this to, you know, for $1 billion, but you're certainly going to make a real nice business out of it that's going to be very material. And it's, yeah, it's just, I mean, it just seems like that a perfect case study of what I think the future of successful e-commerce brands looks like.
Yeah. And I think the big thing is just, we're super passionate about it. You know, we even tell it to our employees, like, if you don't want to come to work, like, I don't want you working here. I want you to love what you do every
day. Even in like just an interviewing aspect, I like to tell our employees, I don't want you to come here for a job. I want you to come here for a career. You know, I want you to look at it and from the aspect of, I want to stay here for a long time, you know, because that's, I think that's the thing, you know, I pride myself in is being able to wake up every day and do something that I love to do and not, you know, not dread coming in, you know, like you said about the pride thing. I think we build stuff and make products that we believe in, and that's what we focus on. And it's not so much we make stuff for other people or what they necessarily think we should make. We make stuff that we believe in wholeheartedly. And then I think that organically, you know,
like it bleeds in.
It bleeds in because we believe in everything we do.
Yeah. I used to think 10 years ago that trying to build a passion, trying to build a business around your passion was a liability, and that there's a, you know, oftentimes passion kind of clouded your judgment, and maybe you're trying to do something that didn't have great economics. And fast forward to today, and also because distribution was so easy to solve back then, right? Like if you could figure out a source for a product and figure out, you know, how to run Google Ads, you know, you could get a great business up and running, and you know, passion was less important. I feel like today we've come completely full circle, and because distribution is so easy and it's so ubiquitous and it's easy to solve for, and there is no competitive advantage in figure out sourcing or distribution or marketing, or less so, especially on the paid side, having passion like you guys do for what you do, you can't fake it. People know it. And it also gives you durability to stick with something for a decade plus. And I feel like it's really flipped to where it's a huge competitive advantage today.
Sure. Definitely agree.
For instance, just to add to that, you know, the platforms that we make parts for, we actually own a lot of world records. So like, say the 6.7 engine, we own the fastest Ford diesel in the world. We own the highest horsepower, you know, and that's all things I think that help solidify the brand of like, well, where are you going to buy parts from?
Oh, and that goes back to your passion because, you know, he wants to be able to prove like,
which I know that doesn't apply to every business, you know, but for ours, it definitely helps.
Oh yeah. Huge credibility thing. Although man, you gotta have somebody on your team that's just their full-time job is doing maintenance on your fleet of vehicles here from tire changes, the oil changes.
Say that all the time.
Unfortunately, it's me.
Well, no, I think you're training our son to do that now. So like last night or yesterday, I should say, our son, he had him up in the engine bay.
Yeah, he was doing
changing spark plugs.
He was doing a tune-up for me at 10 years old.
I love it. That's so cool. Yeah. Speaking of your kids, so your son's 10, you have two, and I don't know if it's your second as a boy or a girl, but are you getting them? Well, it sounds like you are. How are you getting them involved in the business? How often are they in the shop with you working on stuff? Or you try to teach them stuff?
Yeah. So they're 4 hours a day. They have to give us 4 hours a day of work during the summer. So they're 10 and 11. Our daughter ships. She helps package orders, ships them out. We use Finale. She's got her own like little scan tool and like her own login. And so she's doing that. And then our son is 10 and he's helping with oil changes.
More of the hands-on stuff.
Yeah, like sweeping the shop up. Just like I said, changing the spark plugs. And then they're homeschooled. So they're literally here with us 24/7. So his mom comes and helps homeschool them.
That's what this room is.
Yeah. So. His mom helps him school them through the school year. So that helps us work. And then, like I said, they're here.
Man, that's homeschooling. So he's got, his mom's teaching him. And so he's got, because that would be really difficult to be trying to run the business and homeschool.
Yeah.
We homeschooled this last year and I grossly underestimated how much time and energy that was going to take.
Yeah. So Dan's mom started homeschooling them last year or the year before. So the kids, when COVID happened, they were in preschool. And so during preschool at the like March or whenever it was, preschool shut down. And so we were like, I kept saying I wanted to homeschool, but I don't want weird homeschool kids.
We're like, this is a great excuse.
We were like, So we were like, well, kindergarten, they're going to have to be homeschooled anyways.
Because in our generation, we talked about this the other day. It's like homeschooling in our generation, you were a weird kid.
Yes.
If you were homeschooled, like there was just nothing just about it. Yeah. You were just different.
Yeah.
But now I feel like it's starting to change.
Yeah. You know? So they were homeschooled through kindergarten. We were like, let's just keep going. And so by second or third grade, I think we just brought them. Like his mom just started, Dan's mom started coming to work with us every day and helped him school.
They've accelerated.
Yep.
So I think they're both what, a year?
They're ahead? A year ahead.
Year ahead.
Yep.
That's cool. I would say the most interesting, well-adjusted, experienced people I know are often homeschooled, and some of the strangest, mm-hmm. most socially awkward people I know are also homeschooled. There's a real, real kind of like diversion of outcomes there. But you do it. I think it's got the potential to be incredible if it's done right.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, and they're very like, people don't realize how young they are when they have conversations with them because they're very well like spoken. They know the business. They're going to events.
They're around adults all day. Yes, you know, they're not treated like kids.
Adults are their peers.
That's cool. Well, Amy, Dan, congrats on building something really, really special. Amy, you've obviously been in the forums a lot. It's been such a pleasure to have you in there. And it was I was looking forward to getting to hear your story more. And Dan, so glad to get a chance to meet you and hear about the business. And yeah, you guys have built something so cool. Just a lot of respect for what you've done.
No, we appreciate that.
Yeah. And for folks that are listening that, you know, maybe they've got some something that you could make faster or more fun on the automotive side. Tell them just a little bit about SPEmotorsports.com. We've been talking about it all throughout, but maybe if you could highlight the models, the things you sell in the chance someone's listening that could use something.
So the base company, SPE Motorsport, we are a modern Ford product company. So most of the stuff that we make is based around modern Ford platforms, be it the Mustang, the F-150, the Super Duty, the EcoBoost stuff. You know, that's our core, I would say, brand and components. And then we also started a new company called Snyder Motor Company, which is a taking what we've learned from the parts end of it. And we're going to kind of what we talked about in the beginning of this, we're going to take what we've learned from the parts aspect and apply it to putting cars together for people and selling them. And that is I was going to elaborate. So it's the Super Performance and Shelby American cars, which are like the Shelby Cobra and the GT40. And then we're going to take our engines, our drivetrain stuff and put them in those cars as turnkey packages.
Wow. For the F-150 is probably the one that the most people listening have, if I had to bet. What are your top couple most popular products that you sell for the F-150?
For the F-150,
intake and exhaust.
Probably intake, exhaust parts.
And we're really just starting to get into that line more within this year, I would say.
Yeah, I would say the Super Duty, so like the F-250 to F-550 is really the bread and butter for us, I would say.
Just a ton of reliability parts.
We do a lot of reliability parts for them. So it's obviously performance related as well, but a lot of just replacement parts that are just better than factory.
Amazing. I got a real soft spot for the F-350. When I was in college, I had a job where in the summer in Colorado, they gave me an F-350 extended 8-foot bed with this huge cage on the back. And my job was to load it up with supplies and food and resupply these backpacking groups out in the mountains and rallied over, you know, just crazy mountain passes. And I drove it way too fast. And but I had such an amazing summer. And that vehicle I always got a soft spot for those vehicles. It's a good memory there.
For sure.
Well, Amy, Dan, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Hopefully at some point get a chance to meet and talk to you in person, and best of luck with the future of the business. So cool what y'all have built.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
No, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your time and thanks for having us.
If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.